I met a traveler from an antique land who said, two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them, on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions read which yet survive, stamped on these lifeless things. The hand that mocked them and the heart that fed. And on the pedestal these words appear. My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away.
Hello and welcome to Cavaliers Break Bad, the Breaking Bad podcast based on the Emmy award-winning series with the most technical difficulties. So, if you're a regular...
That's the podcast, not the show.
No, the show has very few technical difficulties because it's awesome. But if you are a regular listener, and if you are, thank you, you may have noticed that we failed to put up an episode for the most explosive and some would say best episode of the season slash series, Ozymandias.
Yep, I would be one.
Yep, so this is because due to a multitude of technical difficulties...
And housing difficulties, and heads next door, and just a number of things that kind of just went wrong.
Everything went wrong. So basically, this is just our chance to rectify it. Yes, it's actually going up on the same night as Granite State, which we will get to as well. Also, because of the new change in sound setup, it shouldn't be too bad, but we can't listen to ourselves as we speak for some reason. So the sound's not going to be up to the usual standard. We did get some emails from people, and hopefully some of you saw the blog post, and that was really nice. So anyway, here we go. Yeah. But first of all, I want to start with an email. I don't know if anyone listens to the Rice and Watch podcast. Anyway, they mentioned us in a podcast and then sent us an email, and they're really nice. And I managed to listen to a bit of it, not all of it, because I'm quite busy. And it was really quite good. But anyway, he sent a proper email about, because it's the Rice and Watch podcast, so obviously he sent an email about the Rice and. And if you remember, my theory is that Walt takes the Rice and for himself. So anyway, his point is, I've heard many people say that Walt will take the ricin. I don't believe that is true. Unless Walt wanted to turn himself in for a short time and guarantee his imminent death, maybe to respect Hank wishes to be a man and turn himself in or take credit for his meth empire and give a quick confession outlining his utter brilliance, Walt will absolutely not take the ricin. Ricin ensures prolonged awful flu-like symptoms, and victims often manifest nausea, diarrhea, tachycardia, hypertension, and seizures persisting for up to a week. Walt knows what the outcome of ricin ingestion is and is too smart to let that be his end. If he's going to kill himself, it will be with a gun, exactly like his first attempt in the pilot. Lastly, there is always the possibility Walt will want his death to look like it was his cancer, but I feel that is undramatic. Thought you guys may have much to say about this. Now that you have seen Ozymandias and also Granite State, unfortunately, who do you think will get the ricin and why? Okay, well, I have some of the theories about who will take the ricin, and they're kind of based off of Granite State, so yeah. I can't talk about them now.
Yeah, but I think we should probably just get through Ozymandias.
Yes, one thing I do want to address, though, is the whole thing, it will make Walt sick, then why would Walt take it? I feel like a large part of Ozymandias was him coming to learn how awful he'd been and fully feel the weight of what he'd done. So I feel like that would kind of be a strong... that he would ensure such a horrible death for himself. To sacrifice himself. But also, I think if you think about it practically, he's got to ensure that he doesn't get captured by the police or by the Nazis or whatever. So he takes it, and he knows how to get easy access to something that will kill him slowly. So, I think it's still on the table, but I have some updated theories as to that after Granite State. But let's jump into Ozymandias.
Okay, now this is... Okay, this is just big. This is, you know... Okay, Moira Wally Beckett, great Breaking Bad writer. Rian Johnson. I actually called it now 2 weeks ago, unfortunately, but I called it...
I was listening to the two...
Yeah. I said, I think this may be the high point of Breaking Bad, and I was absolutely right, in my very own opinion. It's my favorite episode so far. I think, you know, the kind of, it just gets so elevated and so intense. This is Breaking Bad at its most iconic. This is what you feel television will be compared to from here. Like, usually have so many notes and so many technical assessments, but it kind of took me the extra week to really, like, develop anything to say about it, because I was just so enraptured by the episode itself. And it's like, just so intense, it's so hyper-technical, particularly with Rian Johnson, but
yeah,
so emotionally connected and everything that I almost feel like I have nothing to say about it other than, yeah, it all fucking works, and it all works amazingly well.
And we want to do this podcast very briefly, I think, because, you know, we missed the moment. That's just how it worked out, yeah. And everyone's been talking about Ozymandias and how it's possibly the best episode. And I just guess we want to just hit on the three main points. So let's first of all start with the kind of the opening and the cold open.
Jesse and Walt.
Yeah.
In the first cut. Yeah.
And it's really interesting because it kind of, it sets up so many things that will be mirrored towards the end. This is the first lie he tells Skylar.
Yeah, yeah.
They're naming Holly. They're about to go on a trip, which at the end Walt is trying to get them to do, but in very different circumstances. And one of my favorites is, could you pick us up a pizza? Which is really funny.
Of course, because of the pizza on the roof.
Yeah, exactly. You know, when Walt tried to bring them the pizza later on, he was, you know, what the fuck are you doing?
Yeah, there's so many touches that just make this just amazing. Just like so, so very early sky, like entirely in blue. And like, just like, it's just so like Holly, like the proposition of the name Holly and everything. And it's just such a really nice little sequence. And also just at the beginning there, you got that shot on the Erlenmeyer flux, the first shot, and it feels like the first shot of Flyers Best I remember, or at least the shots of the fire detector. Is, I don't know, and really just kind of situated it with Rian Johnson, like Johnson directing TV, a really cinematic director doing TV. It's a really unique eye, and you particularly get that
Breaking Bad's just a cinematic show, so he fits in
particularly with Rian Johnson. You really get that in a big way. So you know, like something and then, like, with the dissolves, like, coming across at the end, which is just so intense and so interesting and just odd. Because they shot this cold open a month apart from the rest of the
episode. It was the final shoot of the entire series, which seems fitting.
And that shot of Jesse in the RV when he's just like, dick, at the end. Like, that was the last shot of Breaking Bad, which I find to be a very interesting little... Like, the very last is them going back to the beginning, so, you know.
Yeah, and it's fitting, but what I love also is that it's, it fades away, and of course, the poem ends with, so I should just bring up the exact poem, because I used to know it by memory.
Epic foreshadowing of the knives, so it's really interesting that, like, obviously then the conversation between, Walt and Skylar would have been shot a month apart as well, because that was at the house, they could have done that at the time. They would have shot that, so, like, maybe even the same day as the actual... as the actual domestic fight, or at least around the same time. So that's
what would have
The like Skylar having the come on in the cold open.
Why would they have shot Skylar? Oh, well, right.
Because they didn't.
Oh yeah, right. Of course, because Skylar, they wouldn't really have had to have her grow her hair, etc.
Yeah. Exactly.
But I also love that that it fades away, and of course that echoes the poem. Nothing beside remains, round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away, and it's just what they emulate.
It's,
and then,
actually just, they were just like, you know what we should do? We should actually just take Ozymandias and just
and film it. And then it fades in after the credits with the fight.
With the
And I suppose because I was listening to our podcast of Two Hajili, and we were kind of predicting what was happening. And I really like the way they handled this, that it was the aftermath and they prolonged Hank's life just a bit. And then take him out.
Just even just like that shot where he's crawling towards the gun, and you've got the Nazi crawling over.
And the
timing of that is perfect.
But what's so perfect is there's no tension. You go, he can't do it. There's no way he can get that gun. So it's the lack of tension that is so tense.
Like,
it's the futility.
Yeah, that's true. And also just the way it kind of moves into it, like the camera drifting towards the Nazis, then the camera drifting towards the car.
It's the continuous bump-in that McLaren used at that moment,
but it was kind of a very different kind of very Johnson way of doing it. And then you got the shots that kind of go all the way along the ground, like the reveal of Jesse and everything. And you're just so situated within this director's eye that you're just so safe and happy yet, that you just got Rian Johnson kind of guiding you through this. And it's really interesting, kind of, just the entire, we touched on the Hank thing, just Hank going out the way he existed in pursuit of his white whale, and, you know, really could be, and I said this before, like a couple of casts ago, talking about how it's a show about emperors as much as anything else. If you see Hank as an emperor, and everyone is brought down by their hubristic quality, his flaw, I mean, in the sense of hubris being a characteristic which makes a character meet their untimely end, then yes, this is hubris. Hank being so unfailing, unfaltering in his pursuit of his white whale, which is Heisenberg. But it just works so well. And it's not hubris. It's just this...
It's just acceptance. It's just kind of... But what I also love about it is that he says, you know, he made his mind up 5 minutes ago, is so similar. You know, it's the kind of anti-twist. It's like, well, if they've kept him alive and he's bargaining, there must be a point to this. It's like, no, he made up his mind 5 minutes ago, which felt like an homage to Alan Moore's Watchmen, which has the very famous, you know, why would I tell you about this plan? I did it 15 minutes ago. And of course, that character's name was Ozymandias. So, I don't know if that... I probably wasn't deliberate, but that was a really funny little nod. Indeliberate nod. But also, there's a picture being going around, which I'm sure most people have seen, how Walt falling to the ground is very similar
to... grief marks. There are a lot of grief masks.
Yeah, it looks like a Greek...
It looks like the Greek tragedy mask. Like,
yeah.
I swear, every character in this episode just about gets their grief mask, and they all do that same kind of, like...
Yeah, where it's kind of like the face without the teeth showing. Yeah, it's just kind of the black expanse of their inner mouth.
As you were saying, you've got the comparison that a lot of people have drawn to Gus Fring after Max Arciniega gets shot in episode 8, season 4, Hermanos.
Yeah.
With the 12-minute flashback to Don Eladio and Tio Salamanca. And Juan Bolsa. So, you know, like, that parallel is very kind of eerie and beautiful. And Rian Johnson apparently had absolutely no idea that was going to be the case. Like, it was very possibly, very probably in the writing that would be a parallel, but Rian Johnson said he saw it, like, a couple of days after and had absolutely no idea.
Mm.
Which is, you know, very, very...
And also the other main part that I found amazing about this scene was Walt's final spiteful moment, which was, I watched Jane die. And I think we were talking about this, like, how can he know about Jane? Like, that's gone, that's done. He found out about Brock, but we can't tie up the... And then I think I said, well, if Walt is ever in the position where he's feeling spiteful enough, that was the only way. We worked it out. Yeah. The only... And he did it. Interestingly, also, is that it resolves what was brought in by Fly, another Rian Johnson episode.
Absolutely. That
so he's finishing what he's starting.
That you see that it's in Walt's mind.
Mm.
The guilt or, you know, some kind of sense of that is there. Yeah.
And he also gets to resolve 51 away, which we'll talk about later.
Yeah, but just quickly as well, but I've kind of jumped over something just very... I mean, I understand, like, that is kind of like one of the other focal points of that kind of sequence, but just after everything Walt's been through in 5 seasons... It's 4 digs with a shovel before the aquamarine Nazi hits the money.
And
it's, you know, it's just such an indignity, and, you know, like, the previous indignity of Hank not even getting his final sentence out, then you've got 4 digs of a shovel before they hit $80 million.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and then Gomi and Hank are buried in the hole of Walt's money.
I know, yes. The hole where his money is where his family is. I mean, the visual metaphor is so gorgeous there. But... Like, also, that's another Ozymandias, you know, the empire fades away.
Yeah, and also, like, the pursuers, like, the two who've contributed their lives to, tailing this emperor, find themselves buried in the ruins
of
his estate.
Of his empire, of his estate. The White Estate!
But, yeah, also, so, you know, it's just so much, like, that was a really immediate, kind of intense, visceral fuck. Not the last in this episode, but also Jesse looking at the 2 birds in the sky.
Yeah.
That was kind of worked on a number of levels, because one, it reminded me of Mike's dying moments looking at the river.
Yeah.
It also kind of brought back into play the partnership element, how much that matters to Jesse in his partnership with Walt, in his sense of relationship, particularly with Jane, with Andrea, how much they weigh on him, and also just freedom, just birds flying in the sky when he's about to be shot in the head. But it also worked in the sense that it made me actually think that all bets were off, that maybe they were actually going to shoot him then and there.
Jesse, yeah, I thought, I was like, I would not be totally shocked if they killed Jesse right now, but they didn't, which is smart. So let's move on to that. The next act, I think, because we just want to do this quickly.
I just want to touch on The Watch Jane Die just very, very, very briefly as well. Sure. Where Heisenberg so much previously has, and what has been so much about when he is brutal to people or callous or cruel, it's been so much about catalyzing reactions, in if you'll forgive that. But here it serves absolutely no purpose. It is finally just malice for malice's sake. Like,
that's true. There's no pragmatic ends to
it's
it.
It's just deep cutting despair.
And it's also, it's not methodical, ruthless kind of Heisenberg. It's Walt channeling Heisenberg to hurt someone. Yeah. And it's interesting, actually, I will talk about the end scene and how Walt channels Heisenberg again, when it's usually Heisenberg channeling Walt. But all right, it's just briefly want to touch on the scene where Jesse's in the basement, and because it kind of is moving like a horror movie now, like the...
But just also just like at the end of that, that's like the first 20 minutes that we've just covered there.
Yeah.
And the title credits start after that.
I know. Which is very smart.
You won't see that too many times. It's great.
No,
it's
think awesome. Joss Whedon... That's one of the problems when you put such an intense scene at the start of the episode is you don't want to have the credits playing open it, and you don't want to deal with plot in the cold open. Mm. Or you can, but I think they wisely chose a kind of more, anecdotal, sort of metaphorical cold open, which they're really good at.
Which they've always been very, very good at.
Yeah, and when they try and put the plot in the cold open, it often doesn't work for me. Yeah. But I think that the whole scene with the barrel rolling, I think what kind of struck me was, oh my god, we've got so much. Of course we're going to have a scene where Walt strenuously pushes a barrel along while some
folky,
unbelievably and inappropriately upbeat song plays. It's also a very nice Greek mythology reference, Sisyphus boulder up the hill.
It's a really, almost feels like a nice callback to the Hank kind of looking at them like with the barrel of methylamine when they're doing like, it's a barrel, it rolls.
Right.
Yeah,
it's great. It is also the... Yes, that's very true. I also think that there's just like a really, it's a concise summary of what it is, you know, the difficulty of the money and the pain that it's caused Walt. Mm. But I just love how after all this, and there's this sense of kind of all this pain that he's caused people in pursuit of this money, it's still the sense that it can't be for nothing. Mm. It can't be for nothing. Yeah. This needs to have meaning. I can't leave this empty-handed.
Yeah, and there are a couple of really good shots in this sequence as well, and just the presence of Rian Johnson as well. You've got a shot of, like, Walt in the rearview mirror, and the thing that occurred to me was that it kind of felt like reference to the Heisenberg hat, which up to this point we hadn't seen in a while, just cut off the top of his head a little bit. Then, when he gets out of the car, his reflection is doubled. One way you see him just looking at it, the bullet hole in the car. Another way you see the bullet hole in his head, which is a very nice little, interesting little shot, potential foreshadowing, but... I think my favourite is this Tarkovsky-esque shot where Walt leaves frame, focus shifts like crazy, and it just becomes this blur, and then his face pops up in frame again. It's just really in the barrel rolling. And you just like, and just moments like that, just Johnson just like doing his thing and just works so much. But my favorite thing about this entire little thing is the old Native American guy, just the hello, that beautiful voice, and you like seeing that kind of guy in this kind of sequence, I felt like, I thought it was going to be a moment of, I'm sorry, son, some things can't be bought. But, you know, then he puts the barrel in the ute and drives off.
Is the pants.
The pants.
If you look closely, and it's kind of like, it's one of those things that I don't think, I didn't notice on first watch.
Yeah, no.
Very few people will, but once you know they're there, you're like, well, they're really obvious. They're right in the forefront
they're
of the
right
frame.
Right there.
It's
quite a long shot as well. It's a good, like, 10, 15 seconds for a shot like that.
Yeah, and then it feels like really gratuitous and methodical, but of course, because they're in the space that they originally cooked in, it kind of...
Tragically.
Yes, it makes sense in continuity. They have an excuse to show
callback so gratuitously.
And I believe that they're actually the actual pants.
That's even cooler.
Yes.
That's awesome. That's so good.
So, yeah, there's a big back to the beginning feel.
Yeah.
And but then, yeah, I just love the struggle he goes through with this money. It's just so... And, like, it is kind of, you know, it's just Breaking Bad. Like, we have to have some slightly silly moment to break down the tension that, in fact, actually make the whole process even more tense.
Yeah.
And it's just very much... in line with them. So anyway, once Walt leaves, and Walt, you know, they've been doing this a lot this season. Walt will just kind of go away for a bit, and you just go, "Where the fuck is Walt?" And then we leave. We come to A1.
We go to the car wash. Marie arriving there. A cut to her from Walt at the Ute is kind of heartbreaking because by this point, I think it's the first time in the episode maybe where you've seen Marie and you know that Hank's dead.
I know, and the dramatic irony that fills this scene. And also the fact that kind of it... I mean, look, there was no way really to deal with Hank. Like, Walt was permanently fucked after this situation. Like, there was no coming back, so to speak. Yeah. But, you know, a lot of things were moved into place based on the assumption that Walt was arrested. Like, telling Junior, she only did that because... she thought Walt was done for.
And this is where it does get Shakespearean, because a lot of the things, like, based on miscommunication or, like, assumed knowledge, which has actually changed, and, like, all this kind of
tangled
webs just dissolving and just becoming, just going to shit. So, yeah, no, and I mean, this scene, like, it's really interesting.
Anna Gunn's fantastic. Emmy winner
Anna Gunn now, which is brilliant. But at the beginning, you've got just the mid shot on both of them. You've got Marie and Skylar opposite one another, Skylar in white, Marie in black with a purple flower in between them. And Marie's kind of describing the situation. Then the cut hops the line, and it really does have that kind of subtle, disconcerting effect. And then kind of just cuts between the singles, and it just... Skylar's looked dead behind the eyes before, but this is insane. Nails it.
I mean, this is getting weirdly personal, and I don't want to do this, but it reminded me so much. So basically, my grandmother's very sick and effectively dying, and, you know, she has this look kind of in her moments where she just looks, you know, kind of dead behind the eyes, and she hangs her head, and it's exactly what Skylar looked like. It was so... vivid.
Personal.
I'm not going to say, it touched me on a personal level. I just thought that it's amazing that as an actress that in this, you know, in her moment, in her, like, kind of lowest moment. That is, it's her lowest moment. Mm-hmm. It's when she has to admit to her son kind of the horrible things that Walt and her have done. And it just, I don't know, it's just really impressed me that, you know, this is what Anna Gunn comes up with when she has to play this scene, is something that looks like someone dying. And I can attest to that for once.
Yeah, yeah.
Other than building on top of other tropes, which we usually do. Well, like, you know, I often feel like it's kind of like, the Nazis wouldn't kill them. I've seen The Wire, I know how these deals go down. But anyway, so...
But yeah, from here we go to Jesse. And this is I think you've said it, and a lot of people have said it, really just goes into horror.
Yeah, it just turns into a torture porn film. You're just I'm watching Saw or Hostel, and...
The turn of his head to reveal his beaten face. I mean, we've seen Jesse beaten before. Like, it almost... It isn't a callback, but it feels like a callback to what Tuco did in season one, and I think what Hank did in season three. Like... You know, it calls to mind the, you know, Ringo, meet, you're officially now the cute one of the group. Like,
yeah.
Jesse has been beaten before, and they've kind of escalated to this point. He looks it's next level shit. Like, where Jesse's at, like, with the lump on his face.
Well, I think it was bulge. Slate, or was it Slate, or was it... It was one of those blogs that it was one of those sites that I kind of read but don't, in the same way that I read the AV Club or Seppenwall. But anyway, they were like kind of pointing how they had a problem with sort of Jesse as sort of this tool just to torture for the sake of emotional stakes. And I can see where they're coming from, but this feels almost like it's sort of a meta turning of... Yeah, we've had Jesse, you know, in dire straits before. This is something much worse. This is all escalated. And the Nazis are just, once again, this chaotic force of utter malice that Walt has just unleashed upon everyone, upon Hank and upon Gomi, and now upon Jesse, and in this time willingly.
Yeah.
And I'll be interested to see whether Walt actually ever does get confronted with what he's done to Jesse. Mm. And I think he will, because I think Gilligan likes a kind of cyclical narrative.
Absolutely. Oh, well, yes. He likes a robber or a snake, if you will.
Yep.
For new listeners, that's a gripe that goes back to our season 2 podcast. Anyway, just back to the sequence, just the shot that goes between Todd ripping the tarp off, Jesse crawling around, Todd opening the cage, Jesse retreating further, just that one hold, you know how much I would have loved that. Just like the kind of two focus points just moving between the two. And it is just so well executed. And it's so Johnson.
Yeah, well, there's that, but I mean, not even a particularly Johnson moment. But I'm saying the moment that is neat, strikes me the most, is when they actually get into the lab and then Todd's changing in the background and what's happening slowly comes into focus and he starts moving towards that picture.
And you see the yellow.
And it's kind of this distant tracking shot, and it felt like it was a Dario Argento film or something. It was like, it was really, really very horror. Beyond just the situation, which was very kind of, oh, it's torture porn.
Yeah.
But just the way it was filmed was so horrific. Mm.
And he has that dwarfish dog-like, like Quasimodo-esque movement towards it as well, hampered by, he's moving towards
is treated with such kind of dread. It's almost like, you know, he's going to find the monster. Despair. He's going to find Rosemary's babies. Or actually, it wasn't too different, you know, to when they go to Winky behind Winky's in Mulholland Drive.
Yeah, I suppose. Yeah, but it's kind good of just you know Mulholland just the Drive. Really.
I loved Robert Forster in it.
Oh come on, yeah, that's for later.
Yeah,
but just on the quasi, like he really feels like the Victor Hugo Quasimodo, not so much the Disney Quasimodo, but you know the hideous.
I think Breaking Bad feels like the Disney anything.
Yeah, but the hideous, like, quote, creation of the devil, like, particularly by Todd. And it's just a really nice kind of parallel there. It's just so intense. And Jesse, at this point, gets his own grief mask. Like, we were kind of talking about it earlier, but it's so distorted and destroyed, and it's lit incredibly. Like, because, you know...
Well, I love also what they do really cleverly here is that Todd's out of focus, because all you need to see is the yellow.
You see
you don't
the yellow
actually
and
need
the
to
zip,
see
and you see
Todd
kind of,
change or get... Because, you know, this show has developed such a strong visual shorthand, and they just... It's like, oh, there's a bit of yellow in the frame. Jesse is now a prisoner who has to cook.
Yeah.
And that's one of the strengths of having such, like, a visually strong show.
But the interesting thing about the way particularly just this moment is lit is that Breaking Bad, and I mean, we've touched on it many, many times, is that it has made such a big point of chiaroscuro, and that this is one, but in its own unique way, it's rather than light and dark, you've got light and blood. No, rather you've got shadow and blood.
Yeah.
And you've got a bulging eye completely concealing one eye, but the only point that is visible on the other side of the face is the eye. So you've got this weird thing where one half of the face is completely in dark except for the eye, and on the other one, the rest of the face is visible except for the eye. So you just get this really distorted, like, almost Picasso-esque little...
And
little,
I'm surprised
like,
that
Goya,
you...
really intense grief mask.
Yeah, so that's true.
It's almost Phantom of the Opera kind of, like, in the like, I don't know. It's just so, you know, being aware of where it's kind of come from and where the show, like, its tropes kind of come from, that was a really intense, strong moment.
Yeah, but I'm surprised also that you didn't mention the most obvious thing about Jesse's face is that, like, almost exactly half of it is bruised and bloodied.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Like Gus and the teddy bear. I mean,
yeah, sure. I'm well, again, yeah, like, half face, you know, moral conflict, all that crap that chiaroscuro does, like, you know. Yeah, it kind of goes without saying, and it is a favourite of mine, but, you know, I feel like it's accentuated more in that particularly the way that's lit.
Yeah, I know, but I'm just saying that it's interesting that they kind of give him a, they bring back the Gus Fring pink teddy bear.
Mm-hmm. Like, it never goes away, really.
No, well, I feel now that we've kind of got some perspective from 2011, I feel like as a memorable character... As he was.
Right.
Gus
had less
a role in Breaking Bad than many people think. And I'm glad that these final episodes are being recognized
in
the series as getting truly to its major point rather than season 4. I know some people who went, what? The show goes on after Gus is dead? I'm like, yes.
Yes, it does. It's got
a story it needs to tell. That
yeah.
Anyway.
Anyway, so we move from that sequence into Skylar and Marie post telling Walt Jr.
Yes, and I,
and just quickly, just on lighting again, Skylar lit entirely, like almost entirely from above in an incredibly drenched face is just such a, we haven't seen Anagun look, or Skylar look quite like this. Just that cut is very weird. And again, it's elevated. Like it's part of this kind of elevated reality in this particular episode and just the way it's done. And her eyes are so dark in contrast to like the blonde and the white of her clothes and her skin and everything. It's really intense.
I don't think also that they, you know, they made a very conscious decision not to actually depict the moment where Walt Jr. is told. Yeah.
In the same way that they chose not to show Jesse actually being tortured.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, it's even more so because everyone's been kind of going, well, when's Walt... When's Junior Flynn? Gonna find out? Yeah. Flynn. And everyone... we saw... Well, I mean, Hank found out by himself. We never saw Marie find out, and we never saw... So it's interesting that those moments of realization, unless they come from within, aren't shown. And when we get to Granite State, there's a similar thing I want to talk about there. Anyway, so... Of course, the first thing Flynn does is blame Skylar. And because from his perspective, there's been this long thing of, you know, she's the bitch, he's the kind of martyr. And you can see how he arrives at that because he just doesn't know. So he can't process the idea that he is, that Walt is the villain, you know, the one who has actually done these terrible things and that this isn't some weird ploy by Skylar. And in his mind, you can see how he's trying to rationalize away where she is somehow the bad guy, like some certain weird-ass watchers of the show. And those comments will come back into the episode towards the end. But look, I really just want to jump ahead to when...
How far?
When they arrive at the house.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. There's just one... In Walt's frantic pack-up, there's one shot which is incredibly good, fellas. This is, like, really, like, combination dolly in, zoom in. And, like, the way... On particular reference to the last day of being a gangster sequence.
Yeah.
In Goodfellas. It just... I just really wanted to point that out because it's so kind of indicative of the hyper-stylization of a lot of Johnson's kind of work. And particularly in this sequence that we're kind of going into, it's a really good example of that. But I'll let you jump ahead.
Well, I'd stop taking notes here because it's kind of horrific. But, I mean... there's a lot... This is the most important scene of the show.
Mm.
I say show, and I mean it, because it's the moment when the family that kickstarted everything, and still, look, whether or not Walt was doing it for them eventually, that was always how he rationalized it to himself. They were his, whether they were just a prop or an actual motivation, without the family, there was this sense that, and you know, even with Hank, you know, I will give you all the money to save Hank. So he's isolated his family and destroyed his family, but he still thinks they're a family. And this is the scene where that is destroyed. We were talking earlier about how Johnson gets to resolve what started with Fly.
With Jane.
Jane. And here he gets to resolve what he started with 51. It was Skylar being held prisoner and basically being... her agency was robbed of her, from her. And... she makes a choice to compromise there, to meet Walt halfway and send the kids away, but not completely fight back. And in this episode, when it's too late, but urged on by kind of Junior pointing out how screwed up a lot of her decisions were, she finally fights back. And when she grabs that knife, it all...
Yeah, this entire thing becomes just pure iconic shit.
Yeah, well, when she grabs the knife, of course, it's all done in that very kind of, you focus, you put the prop in the foreground and she's going to get it, and it's sort of...
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you know, Walt's reaction is just perfect. It's kind of, what the hell are you doing? You silly woman, give me the knife. And then she flicks it, cuts him, and the sound drops out, and and it's very Johnson, but it's also just very Breaking Bad.
Yeah.
And look, you know, you're saying it, Johnson, but it is, but I don't think it's anywhere near as distinct as 51 or Fly. I feel like this is, and I don't say that in a bad way.
I disagree, but
I think this feels more like a, you know, a Breaking Bad episode, a standard, in a, and I mean that in a good way, episode of Breaking Bad than Fly and 51. It has much more plot to it, and they need to, and it needs to embody the series more.
Mm.
So I don't think Johnson gets to go on as many kind of auteur tangents as he did in Fly and 51.
Sure, but just in the very act of realizing the action and the story in front of him, regardless of whether or not it's tangential, he covers it in a way that is very, if not unique to him, then definitely options and avenues pursued that not many other directors of Breaking Bad have done.
I mean, particularly
in this sequence, because there are so many, just even the way the house is lit, it feels different. Like, the white diffusion flowing through the windows is quite unlike any way it's been before, and it really gives the whole thing this incredible elevated aura. And a lot of the camera movements, like, really, really kind of hyper-stylized, really almost over the top, like really rapid push-ins, and there's one shot.
But which McLaren is, did that in the episode beforehand.
But not to this degree. Like the difference is that's like Mexican standoff. So you've got people with guns pointed at each other, you zoom in on their faces. That's understandable and tropish. Like, this is a fight over a knife and a family in a domestic dispute of the highest magnitude possible. Like, in at least in the emotion of it by this point. And you've got these moves, like, when they kind of... There's this, like, maybe 10-meter dolly, really rapid push-in. Then you've got a shot which is actually quite... reminds me of a shot in Fly when Walt throws his shoe up and breaks the light. The camera goes right to left as the glass falls at his feet. And there was a really, really... it goes left to right when Walt and Skylar tumble down with the knife.
Yeah,
And it was really very... It just felt very Johnson to me. Particularly Johnson for Breaking Bad. But Breaking Bad. But
the thing Breaking is, Bad.
Baking bread. But, you know, it's... The thing is, more so... I mean, as much as I love McLaren last week, is that I feel that in a situation like this, the family, rather than a standoff between the Aryans and the DEA, which is something you feel to have seen before to some degree, the dynamic established with the White family over so long is a different beast altogether, I feel like. And just, you know, like, we were talking last week how the camera was pushed into this kind of really, really stylized kind of movement by the emotion. This episode more so. Like, it's not... It's just drenched, controlled, and pushed by this emotion, which just makes the shootout kind of look, you know, like... Not like Child's Play, but just not quite as intense as this period, as this sequence.
I'll put it like this. I feel like it's less of a Rian Johnson episode of Breaking Bad than the others because it relies a lot on catharsis. It's people getting shot, people yelling out, people having fights, people arguing with each other. You compare that to Fly in 51, which is very much about subtext. So, I mean, it's partially the subject, and I feel like Johnson...
I suppose I'm referring more to technique.
No, I know that, but what I'm saying is I couldn't recognize that, and, you know, it's been a while since recognize that technique as much. And I think that's partly because in Fly and 51, Johnson's techniques are so much more noticeable because he's kind of creating, he's so stylistically filming, you know, some of the more... mundane, technically speaking, mundane moment.
Well, I mean, it is a bottle episode, of course.
Fly, yeah, but and it flies a bottle episode, and 51 is kind of one of the most domestic episodes.
Yeah.
So his directing is really noticeable in those because he has to kind of elevate what is very sort of simple material. Whereas in this episode, because he's doing such an action... Not just an action episode,
but also melodrama. Not just
a shootout, it's melodrama, it's everything, it's really... big and cathartic. It is. It's the catharsis of the series. Everything Absolutely. They've set up, they're tearing down. It doesn't feel as distinctly Breaking Bad, distinctly Rian Johnson. It just feels more generally Breaking Bad, which is good. That's exactly what he said his intentions was. He didn't want to make a Rian Johnson episode. And look, yes, there are very much Rian Johnson touches, most of all the fact that it's very good. But I would say that, like, I actually found McLaren more recognisable in... last week's episode than I found Johnson recognizable in this week's episode.
I mean, not to say
that was better. I think this is probably the best so far.
But I agree with you, but I think just in the sense that, like, you're speaking to Fly and 51 as being elevating mundane material, this is positively Shakespearean Greek tragedy material, which is also
Shakespearean tragedy, not Greek tragedy.
Okay, fine. But this is also being elevated intensely as well. And, you know, there are so many kind of different elements of mythic proportions that you feel in this episode. It just feels so massive and epic. And
but when he shoots that knife fight, see, he undercuts what he does, because when she draws first blood, right? So there's that big emphasis on her drawing first blood. It slows down. The sound cuts out and it goes into slow motion. So that's heightening already heightened material. But then he pulls the camera back and does this wide shot of them clumsily fighting with a knife. Exactly how two middle-aged people under a lot of distress would fight with a knife. So he kind of breaks away from those moments of heightened style.
I do kind of know what you're talking about, but I think there is enough in there that is quite intense and stylized, though, that does still keep it in that territory. I think I know.
Yeah, it does, but I'm just saying that in that particular scene, he uses that to great effect.
Mm.
To kind of draw.
Mm.
And the scene's kind of so disorientating that you kind of get that perspective that when Walt pulls back and sees what's happening, the image of Junior covering Skylar and calling the police, it's, you know, it's kind of, you get that sense of how has it come to this?
Mm. As the camera pulls back.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, but I think the one shot, or just, I think it's the frame, because it does cut within it a couple times. The one shot which really gets me about this whole sequence is kind of almost the shot or the idea visually realized that I've kind of been waiting for a really long time. Because you know how much I've kind of been aware of kind of the idea of this as like a national news item or a... Or just being public, essentially. But also the fact that it is a drama and it is domestic. There's one shot when Skylar... This is after Walt's kind of kidnapped Holly and is in the ute. And there's also just this... Just on a side note, this look on Walt's face when Skylar's rapping at the door. And I think the first time I watched it, I was just looking at Holly cry because, you know, you can't help it. But he's got this smug look on his face. He's just looking at Skylar and going like, yeah, that's right. And you're just like, fuck. But the shot then cuts across the road. And I don't think this is particularly Johnson or Breaking Bad. This is what's so important about it, is that it feels different. It feels like the shot that I've been waiting for a long time, which Skylar watches Walt's ute pull out on the street. The shot from the other side of the road that... kind of, for me, nails what I felt was coming for a long time, something simultaneously domestic and mythic. It has the feeling of being a neighbor on the street, watching a domestic, or equally, like a news camera or a documentary eye creating an icon. Like, do you know the one I'm talking
about?
Yeah,
no, I know.
It's really handheld and it's really shaky, but it's a wide, and so often you've kind of got really, really just shaky cam, just in on the face and all showing the emotion, but showing the space in which this is occurring and showing the street. And there's a shot, which I don't think we've seen maybe since the cold open reveals on in season 2 or maybe down or over. And it just reminded me immediately of that this is the space
where the plane crash, this
is the debris field, you know, like this is... this space, and there are all these people around almost seeing this happen and this be realized.
And it's
after all this build up and all these different kind of like just things that go ever back for 5 seasons for us, but years for that world. And then Skylar falling to her knees and she gets her own grief mask at this point.
Yeah.
Which is the most, you know, it's just the final touch on this astounding sequence.
Yeah, but I think also what you're, you know, another good point from that is that this is the moment that it kind of, well, it all collapses, obviously, you know, in the broader sense. But, you know, when it moves from kind of the domestic to the documentary and also to the melodramatic. It's very melodramatic because you've got her crying,
oh,
all the
yeah,
music's
absolutely.
Pounding. And it just kind of feels like that's when it escalates. It leaves behind entirely sort of the very insular world of the whites.
Mm.
And they've all been so separate. And actually, someone described this kind of as crawl space on Walt's meth, which is a good description.
Which is really great. I was actually kind of thinking that myself because it was a similar kind of experience.
Yeah, but crawl space is all like those people I was talking about. They're coming, you know, all this shit that we kept preparing for. It's happening now. But of course it wasn't. Gus was a fucking cartoon character compared to what this is. You know, if all of that subplot with the cartel was really just kind of a impetus to move Walt, you know, to examine Walt's character with this kind of threat that never really got close to the family. You know, it was always a possibility, but they never got that close. And now everything was happening, and it was mainly Walt that was driving the conflict.
It was, it was always a threat from outside. And this moment, it's not an explosion, it's an implosion. It's an absolute kind of toppling of the house of cards from like a center point by the person who made it.
Breaking Bad beats the House of Cards many times, though.
Ha, 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 ha,
ha.
Yay. But yeah, as a cinephile, you know, I think this sequence alone is really enough to show the kind of weight of catharsis that you can really put behind moments. It's just brilliant.
Yeah. So anyway, then
we move from this.
When the app comes back, you've got the koala diaper brand thing on the wall, which is just so Breaking Bad. anyway, and you get the moment of clarity for Walt.
Mama.
And interesting behind the scenes, that wasn't planned.
Coincidence?
Yeah, well, because when you're working with children, you need the parents on set, and the baby was behind Cranston, and he was going, mama, mama, mama.
Rather, the mother was behind Cranston.
What did I say?
The baby was behind.
Baby was behind Cranston. There were two babies. Well, actually, there were two babies, because you need twins to film. Yeah. Anyway,
now we get to a phone call. Just some phone call.
The mother was behind Cranston, and she, you know, started saying, and Cranston used that, and of course, it was really good, because, look, I'm all for subtlety, but it's nice to telegraph things to your audience, and you can't direct a child, so the fact that the child quite explicitly states what is the subtext of that scene, that Walt is realizing he can't kind of, in any way, you know, have this family that he's kind of been going on about.
Yeah, and you always, with a young child, particularly just the younger, the more so, you get a sense of honesty. Like, they don't know how to act. And, like, that you have a sense that there is some kind of... Like, when I was watching that, I was thinking, that could have been improvised. It doesn't feel quite as contrived as it might if it was.
Well,
like,
no, because kids can't act.
Yeah, exactly. So they're not, like... There's no real controversy.
What she's
there.
Doing,
like, there's
she's
this
doing.
Kind of raw,
she's not
like,
gonna
actual
act.
Thing
yeah.
happening, which is kind of what makes it kind of slip under the radar, or you can get away with it.
Yeah,
so
we have
from there, you go to the phone call with the
Yeah, well, the phone call is interesting, because, I mean, it takes a while to realize what Walt's doing, and I was kind of watching going, oh, my God, he can't actually be saying that. And then as it went on, I was like, no, he can't be saying that.
Yeah, exactly. And it's an interesting thing, because, I mean, we've kind of pointed to this before a couple of times, but playing one side of a phone call that we've seen earlier this season, particularly it was a 5B, that you've kind of seen one side of a phone call preserved, like, in one space, and kind of almost build the tension as to what's going on the other end of it. And it takes a while for Walt to be revealed, because you're in the White home with Skylar and Marion Jr. and the police. So it takes a while for Walt to even be revealed, and even then, the first shot of him's only of his back, and then cuts back to Skylar. So, you know, the thing is, as you say, and I think, like, we've kind of read a fair bit about this, of just, like, people speculating, like, oh, yeah, good on you, like, yeah, Walt saying it like it is. Like, for anybody out there who hasn't gotten it, it's really clear. He's doing this for Skylar, for the benefit of Skylar, and it's almost his... One attempt.
It's his one selfless act in the episode. He tries to save Hank. It's
making the concession to save his family, essentially.
It works on so many levels. First of all, you've got the fact that it's always Heisenberg playing Walt, you know. It's Heisenberg. Mm. When he has to put the bug in Hank's office, you know, that's him playing Walt so Heisenberg can plant the bug. And now what Walt's got to do is he can't be the family man. He has to burn that bridge, and he has to play the role of Heisenberg, destroy his relationship with his son, and completely put on this act where Skylar is the victim and he is the monster that he is, but not, but man.
Yeah. And it's,
of course, on a meta level, Walt's entire speech is essentially a summary of all the idiot fans. And I'm sorry, like, there are people who don't like her as a character or who think she's not particularly intelligent. That's fine. But there are people who just solidly hate her and think that, and essentially agree with Walt, what Walt says here. And that's what it's drawn from. It's a pretty aggressive attack on the people who have that problem with Skylar. Yeah. And I think what's the beauty of it is those opinions are so absurd that even Walt, you know, uses them as his act, and immediately Skylar recognizes them.
Yeah, and it is important that in this world is that within that the only person who kind of realizes that this is what Walt is doing is Skylar, and you see it dawn on her slowly, and when she finally responds, when she says "I'm sorry," you can hear it in her voice that she's telling him that she understands what he's doing almost, and it kind of brings to mind Walt. It's as close as we're going to get to his promise of "you're going to like me again before this is over."
Well,
I feel like it's as close as we're going to get. But, well, you know, it kind of feels like an appreciation.
We've been saying that season 5B has probably featured Walt and Skylar the closest they've been all series. So make of that a
point. All series?
The closest they've been since season...
A while back.
Since
SFT. What? Fucked Ted.
Oh, she fucked Ted, right.
Yeah.
Didn't
want to have to spell it out.
Maybe it might have been that, or I don't know.
Oh, whatever.
But definitely they're closer than they were in season 5 with the car wash and the kind of partners in crime. It's all very bizarre. I like that Skylar recognizes that, because at the end of the day, there is this sense that Skylar knows Walt incredibly well. I mean, she is really good at seeing through his bullshit. And she sees it in the moment that it really matters. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out in the next episode.
And
I know how it plays out in the next episode.
Also talking about this scene, we get Marie's grief mask as well.
Yeah, when
and
she
that,
find
and
out.
When she sees Skylar respond to news that Hank is gone.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just grief masks everywhere.
Yeah, basically. It's pretty horrific. And then, I mean, I think we should leave it here. And just, you know, Claire, that we mentioned that, of course, you get the nice visual shorthand that they set up with confessions of Walt by the roadside. He's got nothing but a few bags and a barrel full of money. It's always the barrels.
You can also point to, in the fire station after he hangs up, there's a chess game going on, and it's a white king cornered who moves out of the corner, so he's got a couple of...
Do you know the story behind that?
No.
Well, apparently, it's good that you noticed, because they got the resident chess player on the writing team to set up a game where it was like a cornered king, but then they lost it in the production, so they had to like literally hold the film while they set it up. The entire crew were just rolling their eyes like, no, we have to corner the king in the chess game. They really, really was important to them. It's the show of cinematic perfectionists.
And then of course after that, the fireman who finds Holly is Noah Segan.
Yeah.
Of course, from Brick and from Looper and Brothers Bloom.
Bloom.
Yeah, Rian Johnson. Yeah, nepotism. You know, it's nice to see.
You know that apparently Guillermo del Toro wanted to... Guillermo del Toro wanted to direct this.
This episode?
Yeah.
Wow.
And
I'm not a Guillermo del Toro fan so much, so I am a Rian Johnson fan, and this episode was perfect. So,
well, yeah,
you know.
But I mean... Yeah.
Yeah.
And Rian earned it.
Yeah. And also just the last shot of this episode. I always dig whatever it is, TV, film, I always dig a good last shot. And I always also dig a shot with multiple compositions in it. So you've got this one which is on the rearview mirror or passenger rearview mirror as I was on Walt's face. And then the car drives off, zooms out, and just like it's just disappearing into the sunset, and a dog just runs across the road. And just for me, just immediately, I was just thinking, after all that, just thinking rabid dog, problem dog. I was just thinking immediately of Jesse again.
No, I didn't even think of that. I just thought of the kind of serenity that he's leaving behind. It's, you know, going back to the poem, it's nothing remains of his legacy, of his empire. But just on the level that
he is kind of leaving everything behind in this moment. And, you know, it just a dog as the little kind of scraggly dog kind of also calling to mind, like, the Heisenberg that we're also yet to see, like, the vomit-stained guy who we've seen in the flash forwards.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was kind of like a simultaneous feeling of it's all over, but holy shit, we know it isn't.
It's the finale.
Nicely done. I enjoy that.
It's a term.
Yeah.
It's the end of this portion of the story.
And just this episode, after the intensity of everything that happened in Ozymandias, just ending on a note like that.
And I mean, effectively, this is the climax of the series. It's Walt's whole empire building destroying itself from the inside. I mean, Ozymandias is such a nice kind of summary of him, and it's just destroying the way it pays off things that they've set up for years. Jane, Hank, you know, the whole original concept of him doing it for the family. And then, of course, everything he's done for the money, and it's gone like that. It's even in the desert.
In 4 digs of a shovel.
In 4 digs of a shovel. So it's the Breaking Bad episode. It's Vince Gilligan's favorite episode.
Yep, my favorite episode.
I can't say that yet.
I probably can.
Well, look, I mean, I'll give you because, as we said, we've seen Granite State, and I kind of came out of Granite State going, "Wow, maybe I like that as much."
We will literally get right on that right now.
Yeah, we will. So anyway, I think we should wrap this up.
I'd just also like to say just one tiny note. From Rian Johnson's on-set pics, I saw that Slovis, that's all 35mm film stock.
Yeah.
Slovis, good on you.
Yeah.
Just insisting.
Didn't you know that?
No, I don't think I did. No, which is just great.
Yeah.
I
think it's just them and Mad Men now.
Them
and Mad Men, I think, is the only shows left.
That's beautiful.
Walking Dead and Game of Thrones just can't do it because they need CGI.
But yeah.
Anyway.
Peter Gould directing and writing Next Step should be a cracker.
Yeah. Anyway, let's go. Sorry this was late. Thanks so much for bearing with us. We will... And listen, come. So email us at cavaliersdocinema@gmail.com. Visit us on cavaliersdotelevision.blogspot.com. Rate us on iTunes. There's been a few. They're really nice. And someone said, keep up the Vince Gilligan impression. So, you know, that's
we can't take
credit for the Vince Gilligan's impression. It's just...
Holy crap, I thought the House of Cards would win.
If he wasn't out there just being so darn... gosh darn sweet, we wouldn't be able to do these impressions of Vince. So, you know, it's really... We've got to thank him, mainly. Alright, so thanks a lot.
I think we should do the next cast.
Stick around and download, even though it'll appear opposite in iTunes and stuff. Stick around and listen to Granite State, amazing episode, and...
We promise it won't be as much of a clusterfuck as this one.
No, unless our house burns down.
Within the next 5 minutes.
And it has a habit of doing that lately. Alright, have a good one.
Have a good one.